Good morning, everyone.
Good morning, David.
Everyone awake and ready?
Awake and ready.
Great. Join with me in prayer. O Heavenly Father.
O Heavenly Father.
Divine Mother.
Divine Mother.
Beloved Jesus Christ.
Beloved Jesus Christ.
Blessed Master.
Blessed Master.
Dearest Mother.
Dearest Mother.
Saints and sages of all religions.
Saints and sages of all religions.
I bow to all of you.
I bow to all of you.
Free my life from all obstacles. And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my love thy home.
Make my love thy home.
Be thou the only king.
Be thou the only king.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness.
Wish you all a happy Valentine's Day. St. Valentine's must have been a tremendous lover of God to spawn all this channeling of love for one another. And of course, as our society is wont to do, we materialize it and we make it about romantic kind of love in a human sense, but it is also a great reminder of our infinite love affair with God. To have a love affair with God is the greatest thing that we can do. And what that means is you become enamored with the qualities of God. That perfect peace, that love, that joy, that radiance. That becomes more valuable to you than anything else in this world. And as a result of that kind of love, that kind of yearning and desire, you merge yourself into the great being of God. And this would be truly, in doing this, a great celebration of Valentine's Day. Reading from Master's Commentary on the Bhagavad Gita, Chapter 7. Verses 17-18. I'm going to start with verse 16. O Arjuna, there are four kinds of righteous men who pursue me. The afflicted, the questers for wisdom, the cravers for power here in the hereafter, and the wise. Master, here the Gita enumerates the four kinds of virtuous actors in the earthly drama who, to a lesser or greater degree, follow the wishes of the cosmic dreamer. All performers of good actions, whether their motives are selfish or unselfish, are traveling slowly or swiftly on the path of liberation. They are unlike the persons who, by evil actions, walk the torturous path of bondage. Most people in distress seek God, though with the selfish desire of banishing physical or mental ills. They pray to God for money or for healing of sickness for themselves or dear ones, or for some personal advantage, such as avoiding a business failure or winning a lawsuit. Finding temporary relief by the grace of God and by good karma, or by the power of prayer, they easily forget him. I'm reminded of a wonderful devotee that we met in India, and he was a great admirer of Hanuman. Hanuman is the monkey god who is in the Ramayana, and he symbolizes great devotion and great power when he remembers God's name. And so this devotee was involved in, his company was involved in a lawsuit, and if they were going to lose the lawsuit, they would lose the company and his job along with it. So naturally enough, as the writing describes here, he was in a great deal of distress about this. And he was one of the chief people in the company who was organizing the defense of the lawsuit. And so the day finally came for judgment, and he sat in the courtroom waiting for the judge to come out, and so much hinged upon that judgment. And as he sat there, to his amazed eyes, he saw a life-size figure with his own physical eyes, that of Hanuman. And Hanuman entered into the courtroom, and he walked across, and he looked at the devotee, and then he just kept on walking through. And he rubbed his eyes to make sure that he wasn't just having hallucination, and there he saw him walking out of the room. And so he felt this was a tremendous omen, something good for himself and for the company. And it sent chills all over him, and his hair stood up on the back of his neck, and he was just absolutely thrilled. Right immediately after that, the judge came out. He gave the pronouncement, and it was in favor of his company. And so as he's telling this story, tears are coming down his eyes. Now, in contradistinction to Master's description here, he wasn't just what you might call a fair weather, or a foul weather, perhaps, would be a better description, a foul weather devotee. Only when you're up against it are the times when you think about God. Larry tells the story of his son Jared that I find delightful. And Larry and Kate and the family were down at the Seattle Center, and somehow they got sent separated from Jared when they were up in the Space Needle. It's on two different levels there, and they went from one to the other, and they got separated, and they frantically looked all over for Jared. It's a young boy, maybe 8 or 9 years old. And seven or 8 years old. So that's, of course, a big place and lots of people, and they couldn't find him and couldn't find him, and feeling a little frantic about it, they went out finally to the car thinking perhaps he returned there. And sure enough, there he was sitting on top of the car. And Larry came up to him and said, "Were you scared?" And he said, "Yes." He says, "I was so scared I prayed to God." Has to get pretty bad before you're willing to do that. So sometimes that's the way we are. We're foul weather devotees. It's when things are going against us, when we're having financial conditions that are not favorable. We feel panicked in some way. We feel scared for ourselves or for somebody else, and we pray to God. And when the panic passes and the situation passes, and when God takes care of us, as he so often does, then we quickly forget about him. And sometimes all of our good intentions along with it about how we're going to change our life if we just get through this alive. Remember somebody, she's an Indian woman who is a classmate of mine. And she is talking about being in a very difficult situation, and they thought they were going to die. And she prayed to Satya Sai Baba. And as a result, a great miraculous thing occurred, and they were all saved from the predicament they were in. And thereafter, in India, Thursday is considered Guru Day. It's a day that you especially think about the Guru, and perhaps on the altar you pronounce and you have some kind of ritual. So oftentimes it's in India. And so thereafter, even though she was not greatly focused upon God and otherwise, she always kept that Guru Purnima day, of that special Thursday each week. But other persons undergoing even slight suffering in this life receive superconscious intimations or memories of all the sufferings of past lives, knowing themselves capable of violent moods and foolish actions, and fearing the consequent pain and misfortune, such men make up their minds to find God as the permanent relief from all grief. These devotees, heeding the spiritual injunctions of God-realized Guru, embark on the path of yoga, divine union, through which they can learn to commune with God. It reminds me of my own case because I find myself being able to identify with any one of these four different distinctions of those who seek out God. And certainly in the beginning, I almost felt that I was forced onto the path in the sense that I was in such emotional and spiritual pain that there didn't seem to me to be any other solution than to find some spiritual remedy for what I was in, for the problems that I was in. And therefore, because it was an ongoing pain that was in within me, an emptiness that could not get satisfied in any other way, I began to seek out God. And it was almost, as I say, in a reluctant kind of a way. So many times I just wished I could seemingly be happy in the way others were happy. But it wasn't to be at the time. And what at the time seemed to be a kind of curse to me, now I count as a blessing. And isn't that so many times the case? That those things that we think of as our unfortunate place to be in life turns out to be the thing that keeps us totally focused upon God. Otherwise, we might wander away if that weren't there. Men of inconstant wisdom again and again seek divine and aid during affliction, then revert to their interest in material solaces. Yet, even though their prayers are for selfish benefit, such men are performers of spasmodic good actions that remind them of God. They are on the right path. The second class of people are those who unconditionally seek wisdom in order to realize their divinity and to solve the mystery of life. They use their innate endowment of free choice to good purpose and are therefore better men than previously mentioned selfish seekers of God. It is natural that the Lord responds more eagerly to unconditional suppliants for his love than to favor seekers. So there are those who seek out after God, God's wisdom. There are those people who come together perhaps in Bible study class or in Gita study class, and they're striving to understand God. They're striving to understand the principles, the laws, the ways and means for which to attain some better life for themselves and for the world. And these are better than those who are just simply reacting out of some difficult condition. And they are more steadfast. They are thinking about God. They're trying to learn about the ways of a divine life and how to be a saint. The third class of people are those who seek complete fulfillment, which must necessarily include the giver along with his gifts. Such seekers look for God's help in attaining wealth, friends, health, power. They also practice yoga to attain bliss and all-fulfilling spiritual power. In this life and in the beyond after death, in a balanced way, they are trying to find a good life as well as divine realization. Now, for most householders, fit into this category because we come into this world with responsibilities. We come into it with a sense that we have a personal destiny, perhaps, that it is ours to form a family, or it is ours to form a business, or it is ours to excel in some profession, or some trade, or some craft. And as a result of that, we focus the considerable powers that are contained within us for accomplishing these tasks. And these are good things. They're not bad things. They're things that we're trying to attain in this world, and it is required for us in order to go in complete balance towards God. Mother, oftentimes, and I think Master and myself, I know as well, have helped those who come in order to lead a balanced life, in order to be successful in a business, in order to empower themselves, in order to really feel that they can contribute in this world. Now, from one standpoint, you can say this may be an aggrandizement of the ego. But in order to really go to God, we must have a sense of self-mastery. We must have a sense of self-worth. The inner meaning of having the perfect sheep or the perfect goat or whatever it is for the sacrifice to God is that the human ego must be plump, it must be fluffy, it must have something to it. It must be perfect. It can't be imperfect. Otherwise, those imperfections will always trip you up as you try to come into sense of self-mastery. There are those who are living at Anandashram, one Easterner and one Westerner, who have since I was last there, both left the ashram, and one has entered into a married life, and another is seeking to do the same. And along with that, then they go out and they find work in this world and so on. Now, to some in the spiritual path, particularly those who, from the Eastern standpoint, can get the idea that the householder is somehow less than the yogi who wanders the earth or who abandons everything in order to find God. But really, there is no higher or lower. Larhe Mahasya is our great example of that one who maintained all balance in life, did everything, had family, had children, after meeting Babaji, after gaining such a high state of realization, was involved in helping to start a school, was involved with so many different disciples in so many different ways. And yet he lived a life of balance spiritually. Every night, he went deep into meditation. He focused upon the ajna. He talks and describes in his diaries of this light that comes in at the ajna there and how he merges himself into that light, and that light merges itself into him. And he establishes himself in a great sense of oneness within that divine light. And yet in the morning, he gets up and he goes to work, and he fulfills his duties. Now, he's known at work as an ecstatic Baba, so perhaps there was something that was a little bit unusual about him. And yet, to many outward observers, he may have seemed like a very pleasant, wonderful man, but perhaps nothing extraordinary. When people used to come to the ashram, and they would comment on Papa, or Papa would read their thoughts, and he would say, in coming to see a God-realized soul, what were you expecting, that we would have horns on our heads? You know, that there would be something, you know, I think people would imagine that if they were to meet Jesus or Babaji, well, naturally they would know them, you know, they would have an aura, a nimbus surrounding them that everybody would ooh and ah and bow and scrape at their feet. But we read the stories about them, and that's not the way it is. When they sought out Jesus for the crucifixion, they had somebody who was in his intimate circle so they could identify him. You would have to take it, he didn't look that much different than the disciples, and that they would have to choose him out of a group of men who were standing around with him. And so we have this misbegotten notion. There is a wonderful devotee of Larhe Mahasya, Swami Pranabananda. And after he had taken the Swami initiation, he was at Larhe Mahasya's and he was meditating with him, and suddenly Larhe Mahasya said, "You might want to go out into the courtyard. Babaji is coming." And so he got up off of his seat, and of course he is quite excited, and he went out, and in walked through the doorway a young man in his 20-something. He had a simple white dhoti on. And he looked like, perhaps, thousands of others, young men who might be walking the streets. And he's rather astonished by this. And of course, Babaji could see the astonishment on his face. And he said, "Do you think that it's so great that you wear these orange clothes and that I should look ordinary like this?" He says, "I can walk the streets. Nobody bothers me. Nobody wants anything from me. Nobody expects anything extraordinary out of me. So I am free." He said, "You have these orange clothes. Everybody wants something from you." You see? You're not free then. You're not free to wander. You're not free to be in the same way that I am. And so when you are walking the streets, might you be walking right past Babaji, right past Jesus, and never even know it? Do we expect him to be in a robe with sandals, as was the custom of his time? What if he was dressed in a suit? What if his hair was cut short? Would you see him? Would you recognize him? How would you know him? You see? It's a wonderful thing when you begin to think about that God exists everywhere, within every human being. One time, Papa said, it wasn't easy for him to recognize whether somebody was fully realized or not. Well, this was being spoken by a fully realized being. So if it's hard for Papa to recognize a fully realized being, then what are we to do? And I thought, well, the best and safest thing to do is act as if everybody is realized. And then you just play it safe that way. Why not? Why not? Why not look for and see God in everybody? And if they're playing the part of the fool, might they not be a fully realized being who's playing the part of the fool? And you know, on a certain level, this is the truth. Because within our souls, deep within our souls, we are already fully realized beings. We are actors who have assumed these costumes, these bodies, these versions of what we, in the outer sense, in the human mind, come to accept as the ultimate truth. But deep within the soul, we know the truth. We know that we are eternal souls who are merely playing a part. And whether we are rich or whether we are poor, whether we seem to have high standing or low standing, it makes no difference. It is all the same, you see, to God. If you see an actor up on the stage, do you care whether that actor is playing the part of a poor man or a rich man, a wise man or a fool? You're interested in whether he's playing the part well. And if he plays the part well, you applaud him, no matter what part he was playing. And many times it is the hero who is the underdog, who is not the obvious favorite from a worldly standpoint, who is the true spiritual hero. So it turns the world on its head from that standpoint. Now, it doesn't mean that you can't have success. We should strive for success. Mother used to help those who are working and perhaps they are underpaid. And she would say, ask for what you're worth. Don't be shy about it. Step out into the world. Think big. Become something greater. Because you contribute to this world and you bring more of God with you. When you think that you are a conduit for God, that God is the power and the intelligence and the life force flowing through you, and that the more you express yourself in life, the greater the amount of God you bring into this world. And this world benefits from the gifts that you give. Now, they are not your gifts from a personal standpoint. Nobody can take ownership of the intelligence, the power, the life energy that flows through them. It is something that flows through them, not from them. What you can do is become a conscious participant in that flow of life energy. And no two people play identical roles. So God has a specific role for you to play, a specific destiny. And if you do not step fully into that destiny, into that role, then you deprive the world of that aspect of God that God is seeking to express through you. And therefore, the world suffers and you suffer. In order to really live life, we have to step fully into life. So much of my life I spent with 1 foot in and 1 foot out. Because, you know, if you committed yourself fully to something and you failed, well, you were a failure. So went the reasoning and the subconscious mind. But if I didn't step fully into it, well, then who could expect, you know, total success? I wasn't really trying with everything I had. Well, what a convenient lie that is to tell myself. In order to really live life, I have to step into life with both feet. Not 1 foot, not one big toe in and the rest of me out, trying to play it safe. Trust in God. Trust that you have a destiny to fulfill. Trust that there is some great dream that God has dreamed through you. Mother oftentimes said how she felt that she was destined for something great. And she attained the greatest pinnacle that this world has to offer. Now the fact that the world doesn't necessarily acknowledge that, that she's not in the encyclopedias or she's not in the dictionaries, well, that's just the world's problem, isn't it? It's the world's priorities. You look at who the world holds up as its icons, and it doesn't speak that well for the world oftentimes. We will evolve to a time when saints and spiritual sages will be the icons, but the day is not today, perhaps. There are those who gain name and fame. But unfortunately, as we oftentimes see, they fall short of the goal of purity and total oneness with God. But this is all for the working out of the upliftment of the consciousness. And even if we make mistakes, and even if we fail, but we are sincere, it will help take us toward the spiritual goal. Now, there is also an inner meaning of this stage of those who become attached to miracles. And this aspect we have to be careful of. It's one thing to step fully into your life and to make something of your life and to bring the full gifts of God into this life that God has to give to you. But the other aspect, the inner mystical aspect, is that you learn more and more that through your thoughts and through the spiritual energy that God pours through you, that you can be a conduit for the miraculous. There's a wonderful devotee of Lari Mahasya's, Swami Keshavananda. But Master made the comment one time that as great as he was still attached to miracles. You may remember him from the autobiography of a yogi where he described walking through the Himalayas and suddenly a tiger was right in front of him. He was face to face with them. And the Swami threw up his arms and with a yogic spell he put on him, the tiger became transfixed and just stood there and couldn't move a muscle, and the yogi went around him and continued on. But Master said he was attached to such things, and that even Babaji had spoken to him about it, but that it was difficult for him to give up, and it truly is. Master described himself coming here to America, and he would perform different miracles. And at one point, he asked Divine Mother to take all miracle-making power away from him, because he didn't want that attachment. It's very seductive. And so in this inner sense, we have to be very careful. And it's a different stage when we come to that place. It's not building up the ego in order to fatten the calf. At that point, the calf is fat, and it's getting fatter, and it's not good. And so we have to cut it off. We have to surrender that miraculous. Now, it doesn't mean that God can't perform miracles through you, but it happens not by your agency or any thought on your own. Papa once described how he was walking to a village and that somebody came up to him and said, "How is it that you are here? I just saw you on the path." And Papa's hair stood up on end because he recognized the man spoke the truth. And Papa was existing in two places at one time, but he had no knowledge of it. And for somebody who's completely and totally surrendered to God, this is the way that it works. People will describe things to you, and perhaps you have conscious awareness and possibly not. But you recognize the truth of it as they tell it. And as a result of that, you recognize that God can do anything through your form for His glory, for the upliftment of all mankind everywhere. The greatest miracle in the world is the ability to touch the hem of God, to become transfixed by His love, not by some yogic power, and to become immobilized in a human sense and merge yourself into the divine consciousness. This is the greatest miracle. Many miracles abounded around Mother. But I always considered the greatest miracle was her ability to lift me up into a higher state of divine consciousness anytime I was in her presence. And of course, that was possible because she was already existing in that divine consciousness. And no matter what she was doing, where she was at, what the outward activities were, it was always a divine play to her. And this is the fourth stage. And Master continues here, the fourth class of men are sages, defined in the next verse as the greatest of all. Their goal is not the acquisition of knowledge, nor do they seek the Lord for any ulterior purpose. They have already attained steady wisdom and divine communion. Such souls, liberated from the temptations and attachments of delusion, perpetually united to God within their hearts, unconditionally love for Him. They live for Him. They live for Him, act for Him, and commune with Him, just to respond to His love and to revere Him willingly as a son naturally loves the Father. Isn't that beautiful? I one time had a vision of the CEO of a great company. And he had so many people coming in and out of his office, and he had a very large office which kept people at a distance. And they would come for one thing or another. Some of them had questions about the organization and its operation. Others who wanted a raise or wanted this or that, the other thing. And he's a very good chief executive officer, and so he handled all of these things with great diligence. But there is always a certain kind of distance. There is the distance of the desk. There's the distance and aloofness because he had to stand back in order to make good decisions. All great leaders have that. They're able to stand back and assess things coolly and with a detached sense. And then in a moment, the door bursts open to his office and a young grandchild runs to him and throws themselves into his lap and kisses him on the cheek and snuggles into him. And as you might imagine, he is totally delighted. Totally delighted. Now here are all these powerful people coming in and out of the office all day long. But none of them, not one of them, would think of running into the chief's lap and kissing him and cuddling him in the way that the grandson takes liberties to do so. Now we can approach God for His favors. We can be formal with Him. We can be filled with ritual. We can be filled with formality. Or we can simply fling ourselves into the arms and to the lap of the divine. We can pull ourselves in close and feel that divine radiance wrapping us up in its own arms. We can feel one with that. There does not need to be any formality of time or other kinds of things that keep us at a distance, that keeps the desk between ourselves and the President of the universe. or rather we can just simply throw ourselves willy-nilly into the divine presence without reservation, without any preparation, without anything at all, just as we are. It's just as you come, just as you are a party, where you come just exactly as you are, warts and darkness and misdeeds from the past, whatever it is, because they're all cleansed in that divine light, in that divine light. In closing, reading from Rumi, translation by Coleman Barks. Halil, who is a great devotee of God and a saint, Halil becomes ill. 9 days he lies sick in the stable. No one notices, except the Prophet Muhammad. Peace and blessings be upon him. He comes to visit. Halil's employer is ecstatic. With elaborate ceremony, he emerges from his upstairs room and kisses the ground in front of the Prophet. In God's name, please honor this house. I'm not here to visit you. Who then? There is a new moon, new man planted near here, spending the lightness of his humility like blossoms on the ground. Where is Halil? I haven't seen him for days. He must be out with the mules and the horses. Muhammad runs to the stables. It's dark, and the stench of manure is strong. But all that vanishes when friendship enters. Miracles don't cause faith, but rather the scent of kindredness that unites people. Miracles overwhelm unbelief. Faith grows from friendship. With the familiar fragrance, Halil wakes up. How could such a thing be in a stable? Through the legs of the horses, he sees the robes of Muhammad. He comes crawling out from the dark corner and lays his cheek on Muhammad's feet. Muhammad puts his cheek on Halil's and kisses his head and face. How hidden can one be? Are you better? How are you? How? A man sits and eats damp clay for moisture. How is it with him when a flood of fresh prophetic rainwater suddenly rides him along? How is it when a blind, filthy dog wakes up and finds that he's a lion, and not a lion that can be killed, but a spirit lion who shatters sword and javelin with his just presence? How would that feel? A man crawls for years on his stomach with his eyes closed, then one moment he opens his eyes and he's in the garden. It's spring. How is it to be free of how? Loose in howlessness. Howlers sit waiting around your table. Throw them a bone. This suggestion, wash before going to the water tank. The waters there have grace enough to clean and give you peace, but wash yourself of hows before you go. Wash off all the wonderings why and workings out, however. Don't take those with you to the big water tank. So let us enter into that divine presence, even if we're lying in the corner of the stable, even if we're in filth, even if we have no idea that the great Son of God, whether it's Muhammad or Jesus, Ezekiel, Moses, Krishna, Rama, you see, they all stand for the same thing, the same light, the same fragrance of the divine. God is universal. How could it be otherwise? How could it be otherwise? And so let us allow ourselves to merge into that being without formality, without waiting another single moment, and feel the peace and the joy and the love the great love that St. Valentine's must have had in order for this to be Valentine's Day. Please pray with me, O Heavenly Father.
Divine Mother,
I feel the wonder and the beauty
of Thy glorious presence
in every part of my being.
My heart is bursting with my love for Thee.
I kneel in adoration at Thy feet
and surrender myself to Thee.
I feel the power of Thy perfection surging through every cell of my body,
my mind and my intelligence
are radiant with Thy healing light. My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss
of my communion with Thee.
I and my Father are one.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.
Amen. Pronouns, I bow to the light within.